Assalamu alaikum students. On behalf of the Ministry of Science and Technology, Virtual University and Mubashir Humayun, I welcome you to another lecture in financial management. In this lecture, we are going to review the various concepts that we have talked about in risk and return, portfolio theory and capital asset pricing model. There is a saying in English that fortune favors the brave. So, I didn't mean at all to scare you off with the complicated risk theory. At the very least, you should remember the formulas and the concepts of risk, and then you should be able to apply them to everyday life. And in this lecture, we will discuss some of the applications to the real world, other than financial management as well. Now, the first thing that we studied in risk theory was how to calculate the expected rate of return and the risk for a single stock, a single investment. That is what we call a stand-alone investment. So quite simply, the uncertainty comes about because we are not sure what the future price or the future rate of return of a stock will be at any time in the future, a year from now, 1 month from now, even tomorrow. You can't be sure what the price and the rate of return on the investment will be. And because of this uncertainty, there are many possible different outcomes. And we attach a probability or a likelihood to each one of these possible outcomes, and we calculate a weighted average in order to come up with the expected or mean rate of return on the investment. And the formula for the expected or mean rate of return for a single investment is equal to the sum of the probability of a specific outcome taking place multiplied by the rate of return associated with that outcome. So if there are three possible outcomes, then the formula for the expected return becomes PARA plus PBRB plus PCRC, where A, B and C represent the three possible outcomes. Now, as we have mentioned, because there is a probability of several different outcomes, there's a distribution of possibilities. And this distribution is a measure of the spread or the range of possible values or the risk or the uncertainty. And if you look at the graph of a normal distribution curve, then the breadth of the curve is a measure of the risk or the uncertainty. We measure risk most of all and most commonly by standard deviation. So the formula for the standard deviation or risk of a single stock is equal to sigma A, or the standard deviation of A, which is equal to the square root of the variance of A, and that is equal to the square root of the sum of the difference between the rate of return associated with a particular outcome minus the expected rate of return all squared multiplied by the probability of that outcome taking place. So if you take a look at the formula, then the sigma A is equal to the square root of the sum of RI minus the expected rate of return squared multiplied by P sub I. Now this represents the total risk. And the total risk is very important in the real world, because the real world is not an ideal model that the capital asset pricing theory talks about. And in the real world, there is not only market risk, but also company-specific risk. And both of these risks are encapsulated in this formula for standard deviation for a single stock. This is the total risk of a single stock. We then spoke about a collection of many stocks. We extended the same concepts of probability and applied them to a portfolio or a collection of many stocks. Why do sensible investors invest in many stocks? Well, the logic is very simple. Don't keep your eggs in one basket. By distributing your eggs across different baskets that are not correlated, you can reduce the risk that you will break your eggs. So, quite logically then, experimental studies have shown that rational investors or sensible investors who invest in as many as 40 different stocks of different companies that are not correlated to each other and that are from companies that are in different sectors or industries in the economy, that it is possible to eliminate as much as half of the total risk. But what kind of risk has been eliminated? The risk that can be eliminated is known as the diversifiable risk. And that is the company-specific or unique risk. Risk that takes place or happens because of random events in the life of a company. So, the diversification or investment in an increasing number of stocks reduces the overall or total risk. And even if you can diversify in as few as 7 different stocks that are uncorrelated, it is possible to reduce a large portion of the company-specific risk. We mentioned that the total risk of a stock is equal to the market risk plus the diversifiable risk. And we then spoke about the expected rate of return on a portfolio or a collection of many stocks. Well, the rate of return of a portfolio is very straightforward. Once you know the rate of return of the individual stocks that are part of the portfolio, and once you know how much money you have invested in each stock. Quite simply, the expected rate of return on a portfolio of 3 stocks, A, B, and C, is equal to XA RA plus XB RB plus XC RC, where X represents the fraction of the investment in that particular stock relative to the total value of the investment in all stocks, and R represents the rate of return on a particular stock. So it's a simple weighted average formula. We then moved on to the calculation of the total risk for a portfolio of many stocks. And we mentioned that the formula for the total risk of a 2-stock portfolio or a portfolio that has only 2 stocks is straightforward. The sigma P, or the portfolio risk for a 2-stock portfolio, is equal to the square root of XA squared sigma A squared plus XB squared sigma B squared plus 2 multiplied by XA XB sigma A sigma B rho AB, where sigma represents the standard deviation, X represents the fraction of the investment in that stock, and rho represents the correlation coefficient between the 2 stocks A and B. And correlation coefficient is a measure of the tendency of the 2 stocks to move together, of the prices to move together. And if they move together exactly, then the correlation coefficient is plus 1.0. And if they move exactly in opposite directions, then the correlation coefficient is minus 1.0. And if there is no relationship between the movement of the 2 stocks, then the correlation coefficient is 0. Now, we mentioned that if you have a portfolio of more than 2 stocks, then you can't use this standard deviation formula for the 2-stock model. Then you have to use what's known as the risk matrix. And This is a very, very simple way of remembering how to calculate the standard deviation of a portfolio of any number of stocks. You simply set up a matrix with the different stocks represented in the columns and in the rows, and then you have certain variance terms that are simple terms containing just the fraction of the investment and the standard deviation of that stock along the diagonals of the matrix, and all of the other terms other than the diagonal are covariance terms that contain the correlation coefficient rho. Please take a look at that risk matrix to review the calculation of standard deviation for a portfolio of more than two stocks. The portfolio theory told us that there is a direct relationship between risk and return, and as risk of the investment goes up, then the expected rate of return also goes up, because investors will not take on any extra risk without getting extra rate of return along with it. We mentioned that in the case that the correlation coefficient is less than or equal to zero, in other words, if it is negative, then the risk and return relationship between two stocks exhibits a hook-shaped curve. Now, this hook-shaped curve is very important to understand, because what it shows is that it is possible that when you add another stock to your existing portfolio, that you not only increase the overall return of the portfolio, but that you can also reduce the total risk of the portfolio. And that is ideal, because the objective in portfolio theory is to maximize the total return of the portfolio and to minimize the total risk of the portfolio. So please don't forget the hook-shaped curve. We then extended the hook-shaped curve for a portfolio of more than two stocks, and we mentioned that you arrive at a parachute-shaped curve, and the parachute-shaped curve can form a large envelope or a large hook that is the efficient frontier, which represents the most efficient combination of the different stocks in that portfolio. We then extended this concept of the hook-shaped curve for a portfolio of more than two stocks, and when we added a third stock, C, we came up with a parachute-shaped curve, and we also came up with a curve that envelops both of these curves, which is known as the efficient frontier. So let us take a look at the all-important efficient frontier, and let us see how from that we can derive the capital market line, or the CML, and the equation of the capital market line. So the graph shows that on the y-axis you have the portfolio return, on the x-axis you have the portfolio risk, and this is the case of a three-stock portfolio, stocks A, B, and C. And you will note the parachute-shaped curve, and the outermost curve represents the efficient frontier for the three-stock portfolio. These are all the combinations for investing in stocks A, B, and C that are efficient. But that doesn't help us, because there are too many combinations to pick from, and we need to decide which one of these combinations is the best. And this is where the capital market line helps us, because what we say is that every investor has access to a risk-free treasury bill portfolio with a risk-free rate of return, which we will assume is 10%. Once you know that point on the graph where the standard deviation or risk is zero and the risk-free rate of return is 10%, which is on the y-axis, you can then extend a line from this point to a tangent on the efficient frontier, and that point of tangency which has been shown with a large dot, represents the optimal or the best portfolio mix. On this particular graph, it appears as if approximately 50% A, 30% B and 20% C represent the optimal mix. The closer the curved distance is to a particular stock, the higher the percentage of that stock in the portfolio. Now, this capital market line is very, very helpful because it allows us to come up with the expected return on the portfolio, and the formula for RP star is equal to R sub RF plus RM minus R sub RF divided by sigma M all multiplied by sigma P, where R sub RF represents the risk-free rate of return, RM represents the market rate of return, sigma M represents the risk or standard deviation of the market, and sigma P represents the standard deviation or risk of the portfolio. And this formula has been shown to you at the top of this graph. We then moved from the portfolio theory to the capital asset pricing model, and the building block of this capital asset pricing model, or CAPM, which is the beta coefficient. The beta coefficient focuses our attention on the market component of total risk. We mentioned that in efficient markets and in perfect capital markets, the only relevant risk that has a bearing on the price of a stock or on the rate of return is the market component of the risk, not the total risk. Now, the beta coefficient for a stock measures the tendency of that stock to move with the system or with the market as a whole. The beta coefficient can be arrived at in two ways. One of them is to graph the percent change in the rate of return of the stock against the percent change in the rate of return of the market. And the beta coefficient is simply the ratio of the two. If you plot a line on the graph, then the beta coefficient represents the slope of a line that passes through the data points that represent the combinations of the change in the rate of return in the stock relative to the change in the rate of return in the market. So this regression line has a slope whose value is the beta coefficient. Incidentally, the y-intercept of this line represents the alpha coefficient, which represents the company risk or the specific or diversifiable risk. We mentioned that there is another way of theoretically calculating the beta coefficient using our fundamental probability variables of standard deviation and correlation coefficient. Let us take a look at these formulas on the slide. The stock beta formula in terms of the stock standard deviation and covariance is as follows. The beta of A is equal to sigma A sigma M rho AM divided by sigma M squared. That is equal to the variance of stock A with the market divided by the covariance of the market itself. And that is equal to sigma A rho AM divided by sigma M. Here sigma represents the standard deviation and rho represents the correlation coefficient. We then also stated that because the total risk is equal to the market risk plus the company specific risk, we can calculate the market risk, which is what matters in an efficient market. The market risk of a stock is equal to the beta of the stock multiplied by the standard deviation of the market, which is equal to beta A multiplied by sigma M. And if you plug in the definition of beta into this equation, then the market risk is equal to sigma A multiplied by rho AM. So we then figured out two ways of calculating the beta coefficient and one theoretical method for calculating what the market component of the total risk for a stock is. We then wanted to find out how we can use the beta coefficient practically. And the answer was given to us in the form of the security market line, or SML. The SML is the most important part of the capital asset pricing model, and it allows us to calculate the required rate of return of a stock in terms of the beta or the market risk of the stock. This is very important because we use the required rate of return in our formulas for calculating the stock price earlier on, the Gordon's formula, and we also use the required rate of return as the R value in our net present value and our present value formulas in capital budgeting at the very beginning of this course. So that is why it's important to understand how we arrive at the required rate of return. We mentioned that in efficient markets, the market will not compensate the investor for taking on any unnecessary risk. So the market will not give you any extra return for taking on unnecessary risk like the company risk, which you should have diversified by investing in many different uncorrelated stocks. The efficient market will only give you a return and will only price the stock based on the market component of the risk. So that is the relevant risk in the efficient markets. Now, we came up with the equation for the security market line, and we also took a look at the graph of the security market line, both of which are very important to understand. So let us take a look at that graph. The security market line, or SML, for an efficient stock is shown in the graph. On the y-axis, you see the required return, R star, and on the x-axis, you see the beta risk. The security market line is a straight line that starts at the risk-free rate of return, which in the case of Pakistan we have assumed to be 10%, and it passes through the market point, which has been showed to you in the middle, and that is the point which is represented by a beta of plus 1.0 and the market rate of return RM, which in our example is 20%. In the example that's been shown to you, the stock A has a beta coefficient of 2.0 and a required return of 30%, and it lies exactly on the security market line, which means that it is an efficiently priced stock and that its total risk is equal to the market risk. You will note, looking at this graph, that there is a risk premium, which is the extra return over and above the risk-free rate of return. Even the overall market has an extra rate of return because the market has a certain risk. The risk of the market or the beta of the market is not zero. Therefore, it has a rate of return, RM, of 20%, which is higher than the risk-free rate of return. The rate of return of our stock A is 30%, and that is even higher than the market. And the reason for that is because the risk of the stock A, or beta A, is equal to 2.0, which is more than the beta of the market. So the market compensates investors who are investing in stock A by giving them an extra rate of return or a risk premium. If you look at the SML formula at the top of the graph, that is equal to the required rate of return for stock A is equal to the risk-free rate of return, R sub RF, plus the difference in the market rate of return and the risk-free rate of return, RM minus RF, multiplied by the beta coefficient of stock A. Of course, it should be clear that the capital asset pricing model and the portfolio theory are idealized representations of the real world. They do not represent reality. Therefore, the assumptions of these theories naturally lead to certain weaknesses. And let us go over some of those weaknesses that have been criticized for both the capital asset pricing model and the portfolio theory. If we talk about the security market line model, which is part of the capital asset pricing theory, then there are a couple of very, very strong objections that have been made. The first one is that in real markets, not all of the investors are rational, and not all of the investors maintain fully diversified portfolios. The market is full of all kinds of investors. Some investors have invested in only one stock, some have invested in two stocks, Some have invested in 100 stocks. There are individuals investing. There are companies investing. Mutual funds are investing in the stock market. So you can't assume that every investor in the market has a fully diversified portfolio of more than 40 stocks. So that is one objection to this model. The second objection is that the capital asset pricing model does not consider or take into account the impact of taxes and the impact of brokerage commissions, money that is wasted because of the commissions that you pay to the stockbroker who helps you to buy and sell shares in the market. So these are weaknesses in the capital asset pricing model that imply that it's not enough to be able to calculate the required rate of return on an investment simply based on the market risk. The point is that people have objected and said that there are other factors that also affect the calculation of the required rate of return on a stock. And the objections are valid, but the power of the capital asset pricing model is the simplicity and its ability to work reasonably well, even in markets that are not entirely perfect. Now, let's take a look at the weaknesses that have been pinpointed regarding the capital market line, which is part of the portfolio theory. We mentioned that in order to calculate the best or optimal portfolio combination, we need to assume that every investor has access to a risk-free T-bill portfolio. That means we are assuming that every investor can borrow money and also lend money at the risk-free rate of return. But practically speaking, that's not possible. For example, in Pakistan, it's not possible for the average investor to borrow money at 10%. The borrowing rate, practically speaking, is always higher than the lending rate. So this causes a disparity or an error in the estimation of the required return of the overall portfolio. Now, two gentlemen whose objection has been very famously taken into account regarding the capital asset pricing model are Farmer and French, and they pointed out that there are other factors that are better measures of the required rate of return on a stock. And what they mentioned was that the required rate of return on a stock is higher if you are talking about a firm of a smaller size and if you are talking about a firm with a lower market to book ratio. Now, what this means is that what they're suggesting is that it's not the market risk that is the key determinant of required rate of return, rather the size of the company and the ratio of its market value to its book value are more important. But there have also been some errors in the experimental studies carried out by Farmer and French, so their objection is not entirely valid because it is based on historical data, whereas the capital asset pricing model talks about estimated future data. This makes, by the way, the capital asset pricing model very difficult to criticize because it is based on future expected data. Finally, an alternative has been proposed to the capital asset pricing model, and that is known as the arbitrage pricing model. The arbitrage pricing model explicitly takes into account other practical factors that affect the calculation of the required rate of return. And it mentions that factors such as the macroeconomic interest rate, the price of oil, the inflation rate, and taxes all affect the practical calculation of the required rate of return. So it is because of these practical criticisms of the capital asset pricing model and the portfolio theory that we need to always fall back and rely on our fundamental probability measures of risk and return. And we have to go back to the expected rate of return formula, which uses probability, and the standard deviation formula, which is a measure of the total risk. Because it is the total risk which is important when you talk about real world markets, the reality. Now, the value of the capital asset pricing model can't be denied because it provides a simple formula which works quite well for calculating the required rate of return. And it's critical to calculate this required rate of return correctly, because we use this required rate of return in calculating the net present value of real assets and companies and firms, and we use the value of the required rate of return to discount the future cash flows from operations of any company in order to calculate the value of that company. The required rate of return that the capital asset pricing model provides us is also very important because it allows us to calculate the price of a common share. If we assume Gordon's formula, which is that for perpetual investment in a common stock with a constantly growing dividend growth rate, then we can use the required rate of return in this formula to calculate the price. In both cases, we do not use the expected rate of return, but we use the required rate of return, because it's the required rate of return which is a function of the individual's personal risk profile and the individual investor's opportunity cost of capital. And please keep in mind the difference between the required rate of return and the expected rate of return. The expected rate of return is simply the weighted average of the possible future outcomes. So, in the real markets, the total risk and the expected return are very important. When we talk about the ideal case of efficient markets in the capital asset pricing model and the portfolio theory, the market risk and the required rate of return are what become important. So, ladies and gentlemen, جیسے کہ میں نے پہلے کہا, رسک اور ریٹرن تھیوری میں جانے کا مقصد یہ نہیں تھا کہ میں آپ کو ڈرا کے آپ کا طرح نکال دوں. مقصد صرف اتنا تھا کہ ہم رسک کو بہتر سمجھ پائیں اور رسک کو کیلکولیٹ کر پائیں تاکہ ہم سمجھدار فیصلے کر سکیں سرمایہ کے حوالے سے اور انویسٹمنٹس کے حوالے سے. بلکہ میں یہ بھی کہوں گا یہاں پہ کہ ہلچل یا انسرٹنٹی کے بغیر زندگی کا مزہ ہی نہیں ہے, زندگی بہت پھیکی ہو جاتی ہے. تو رسک سے بھاگنا نہیں ہے, رسک کو سمجھنا ہے اور رسک کو قابو کرنا ہے. ساتھ ہی ساتھ میں رسک تھیوری میں جانے کا یہ مقصد نہیں تھا کہ ہم اس کا کوئی عملاً فائدہ نہ اٹھا پائیں. رسک تھیوری کی بہت سی اپلیکیشنز ہیں اور ان کے بارے میں ہم کچھ ابھی بات کرتے ہیں. It takes a creative mind to think of practical applications for any theory. If you are studying the concept of recursion in mathematics or in computer science, then you need to expand your mind to think of how you can use this in everyday life to reduce your level of work instead of doing the work repeatedly. Similar tasks should not be done again and again. If you studied the concept of iteration, then it should also help you to reduce your method for searching for something. If you study the concepts of circuit theory, in electronics, then it should help you to organize your workflow, because systems engineering is based on the principles. And production management and scientific management, which was started off by Frederick Taylor and perfected by the Japanese, is based on these engineering principles. Similarly, if you are studying risk theory in this course, you should not be restricted to thinking of applications only in the area of finance. There are many applications to risk theory, and you need to think out of the box. So, let me just hold your hand and introduce you to some of the applications of risk theory in everyday life. In order to apply the concepts of risk theory to everyday life, we need to go back to some of the fundamental concepts. The first one was that of expected return or expected value, also known as expected payoff. That is simply the weighted average of the possible returns from all the different outcomes. The second concept is that of the standard deviation or total risk. And again, we used a formula in terms of probabilities and rate of returns for calculating the total standard deviation or the total risk. The third important concept, which has applications to everyday life, is that of systematic risk, or beta, and the concept of how much the risk of a particular individual member of a larger system, how much that risk is compared to the overall risk of the entire system. So you have to use and play with these three concepts of risk theory and think of applications in the real world. Now, just to start you off in your thinking process, one of the applications that risk theory has been used in very effectively is for assessing the social welfare cost-benefit analysis for very, very large projects. For example, the hydroelectric dams. And the risk theory allows you to account for the uncertainty that is associated with environmental damage that takes place when you set up a hydroelectric dam. When you set up such a dam, then you have to relocate people from their villages. You have to relocate these villages possibly hundreds of miles away. A certain large volume of a valley gets flooded, and that has environmental damage in terms of the habitat and the animals and the wildlife that lives there. How do you assess the value of this damage? How do you estimate the cost? There is an uncertainty, and so you can use the risk theory for this purpose. There is also an uncertainty in the case of a hydroelectric dam in terms of what the exact benefits are. When in Pakistan a hydroelectric dam comes about, then there are net savings because the country does not have to import as much fuel oil, which they would otherwise have to if they set up a thermal power plant. And the savings are or can be difficult to estimate. So there is also possibly an uncertainty attached to the savings or the benefit side of the equation. We can also apply the concepts of risk theory to court cases that we face in everyday life. Why? Because there are a lot of uncertainties attached to a court case. One of the uncertainties is not knowing exactly what the benefits or the value of the claims will be from the court case. Another uncertainty is whether you will win the case or not, whether the judge will pass a favorable sentence in your favor or not. And, of course, there is also the uncertainty of not knowing how your opponent in this court case is going to behave. So you can use the concepts of risk and uncertainty and probabilities to estimate the expected return, and from that you can calculate the standard deviation or the risk and get some idea of whether or not you should waste your time and energy and effort in a particular court case. We don't have time in this course to go into the numerical details of these analyses, but they can be done. A third and very important application of the risk theory is in the area of war. It's no secret that the Indian-Pakistan border is one of the most dangerous borders in the world. Both India and Pakistan are nuclear powers. And you can apply the concepts of risk theory to gauge the likelihood or the possibility of a war taking place. There are two factors that military analysts consider very important. One of them is the capability for war, and the other one is the intention of the two sides to start a war. The capability is measured by the hardware, the armed forces, the personnel, the army, the number of airplanes, number of tanks, mortars, ammunition and so on, gunships. These are all part of capability. And intention is the seriousness with which the leaders, the political leaders and the military leaders actually want to fight. And you can attach probabilities to each one of these factors and come up with a qualitative ranking of the likelihood of a war taking place. So risk theory has many, many practical applications, and try to stretch your mind and be creative in coming up with the possibilities for applying these concepts of risk theory. With this, I will close the material that we have reviewed about the risk theory, the portfolio theory and the capital asset pricing model, and the applications of the risk theory to everyday life. And we will review some of these concepts again when we talk about the risk theory and apply it to real businesses and real projects. Real businesses and projects have net operating cash flows, which are uncertain because they have been forecasted for the future. And we can apply the concepts of probability in doing the net present value analysis for a particular business. This will be very helpful for those of you later on who decide that they want to buy a company or a factory or a bank from the Privatization Commission of Pakistan. So it has practical value. Already the concepts of capital asset pricing model should help you in investing your money in the stock markets of Pakistan and making a lot of money. With this, I close this particular lecture on the review of the risk theory. We will continue our discussion in the following lectures regarding capital structure and dividend policy and the application of the risk theory to cash flows of a real business. I thank you for your kind attention and patience. I also apologize for forgetting to tell you to unfasten your seat belts, because the most difficult and complicated theoretical portion of this course is now over. So congratulations to all of you for surviving. Iske saath hi aapko Ministry of Science and Technology, Virtual University of Pakistan aur Mubashir Humayun ki taraf se bahut bahut shukriya. Khuda hafiz aur assalamu alaikum.